Welcome to Habits for Your Happily Ever After, where we get clear about your marriage communication. Because when your relationships are strong, you're able to concentrate at work, reduce conflict at home, and receive support for your dreams so that you have the courage to live your best life. I'm Rebecca Mullen, a relationship coach living in Western Colorado, and my guest today is speaker, teacher, and poet Rosemary Wotolla Trommer. Rosemary was the first poet laureate of San Miguel County in Colorado and was a finalist for the Colorado Poet Laureate in 2019. She's been writing a poem a day since 2006 and sending those just written poems into email inboxes all over the world. When I practice writing poetry with Rosemary, she always says to me, "It doesn't have to be beautiful, Rebecca, but it has to be true." Rosemary has a nose for the truth like no other. Her podcast, Emerging Form, recently posted its 100th episode, and she has a long list of clients for whom she has curated a creativity play shop, and that's play shop instead of workshop. I've linked to her website, and I encourage you to subscribe to her newsletter and hire her, because her work will make love come alive in your life. 2.5 years ago, Rosemary's son Finn died by suicide. I wanted to talk with her here about how Finn's death impacted her marriage to her husband, Eric Trommer. Thanks for doing this with me, friend.
I'm glad to be here with you, Rebecca.
I wanted to start at the big house up at 12,000 feet. What was that? Is that the first house that you lived in with Eric?
It is. It is. He had just finished building that house when I met him. He had finished it that week.
No way.
The house is right at tree line at the top of Telluride ski area. It's a beautifully built house in the middle of really almost nowhere at the top of, cliffs. And it's at that point was the hike to ski terrain, but now it's just above lift 9 and below lift 14 in Telluride.
And you had to ski away from your home, right?
In the winter, the way to get to town was either to ski down or download, I suppose, which is what I had to do before I knew how to ski. Or you could take a snowmobile down before the ski area opened.
Yeah. What's download mean?
Oh, that means you take a chairlift down instead of up.
Okay. Instead of uploading on the chairlift, you're down.
Yeah, I would just say that's a fairly embarrassing thing to do.
Everybody's wondering, why is she coming down?
Why are they doing that? Yeah.
So you only learned to ski after you met Eric?
Yes. It's a little more complicated, I suppose. But when I lived in Finland was when I learned how to downhill ski, really. And I fell and hit my head, got a concussion, and it was fairly miserable, but then I had to take the night train back to Helsinki with the concussion, which was extreme misery. And that was when I decided I would never, ever ski again. I got to meet my never when I fell in love with a man who lived on top of a mountain.
So how did you go, okay, I guess I'll meet this extreme fear and I'll let myself fall in love with a man who lived at the top of a ski area?
Well, you know, when I first met him, of course, it was spring, so I didn't have to ski to get to the house.
Then it was too late by the time the snow fell.
And then, you know, the next time I met him, it was summer. And then I moved in with him in the fall. So, I'd had a chance to live up on the mountain before the ski area had opened. And I was going to have to learn how to ski, which of course I eventually did. You know, it was impractical for sure not to. And then it turned out it was fun, you know, and we had quite a time living up there. And we were up there for 7 years, and it was always an adventure.
Yeah. I mean, come on, like getting groceries was an adventure and then some.
You know, we would just buy groceries mostly on a day-to-day basis. We'd just go and whatever we could fit in our backpacks. That was usually how we did it.
And you lived that way for 7 years.
We did. It was quite a, it was a sweet life in so many ways. You know, I think that it was certainly full of physical hardships sometimes, but there were also so many just glorious times. After a couple of years, they built a gondola that went halfway up the mountain so we could take the gondola halfway. And then in the summers, we could just hike home. It was glorious. By the time you got home, we had walked off the day and we were in fabulous shape. And I knew everything about the stars at night. And I knew everything. I knew all about the animals. I just was very in touch with the natural world up there. It was quite a glorious life, really. And that, to be that cocooned, I think, the two of us at that point in our pre-marriage marriage, first few years of marriage, I think that was, it was really good for us.
How so? I mean, that is really cocoony. When you say it was good for us.
Yeah, I mean, it was, I think especially, you know, I think that it created a space for us just to be together, just the two of us. Sometimes Eric's daughter came up with us also, Shawnee, which was always lovely when she was with us. We, I think, realized very quickly that the three of us had a very positive, strong dynamic.
It feels like the beginning of your relationship was very lover intensive because just daily living was very adventurous.
It was, and I think also a partnership. You know, I mean, we were certainly in it together, just the things that we had to do to live up there, you know, farming water, for instance. I had this huge tank that we had to figure out how are we going to get snow melt into this tank. You know, just there were lots of, I think, partnership things, but, and maybe they were, you know, partnership slash lover, just because it was an adventure, everything. And at that point in our lives also, I think we were very adventure oriented. You know, we were climbing mountains and running rivers, and it was very outdoor adventure rich. That was our pleasure. That was our joy, was going out and having adventures.
Did you ever struggle with the partnership piece of it? Did you ever have moments where it was sort of like, I'm doing all the farming of water? I don't even know how to ask a question about farming water, Rosemary.
No. No, if anything, I was not the lead on that. And maybe that was not easy for me to be always the follower.
Because you're used to being a leader in life.
More than I was in that situation. You know, certainly Eric still to this day, he has a beautiful technical mind. He understands how things work. It's all fun and problem solving for him. And I look at it, I'm like, I don't know, you do it. So, you know, in a way, I think that part of the partnership was me learning how to follow, you know, when he was leading in things that were difficult for me that way.
Did you get pregnant with Finn at that house?
Oh, heavens no.
Okay.
I think that would have been very difficult to have had a young child up there. In fact, I really can't quite imagine how that would have worked out. So we sold the home in 2000, built this home where we are still to this day, down by the river, an entire mile lower.
Did you go to bed at night just going, there's so much oxygen in the air here?
I remember when we built this house, I was like, what? So we're just gonna what, drive to the front door? I was kind of upset about it. You know, Eric would just say, you know, I'll just drop you off, you know, at the end of the, you know, over on the highway, and you can walk home if you want.
That's really cute.
And then when we and so when we moved in here, then it was my stepdaughter Shawnee was in college at that point. And Eric and I were starting to talk about having a child, and we decided we didn't want to do that until Shawnee was fully out of college and out of her room, so that we had a 2-bedroom house, so we didn't want her to feel like she'd been pushed out. So we waited. That was part of the reason, I suppose, that we waited until she graduated and had a home of her own, and then, in short order, we had a baby.
And the first year of Finn's life was something.
Was really difficult. Yeah. Finn was born month early on September 11th, 2004. And his first month he slept, but after that he screamed for the next year. And it's not, you know, I know some people say, oh, my baby has colic, and it, you know, they cry for an hour in the afternoon. It was not like that. It was something, somehow he was hurting and no one could explain why. You know, I went and took him to so many doctors, and they, I remember the one doctor just saying, oh, you have a cranky baby. He was in pain, obviously, but, you know, I took him to a chiropractor. I took him to the naturopath. I took, like, anybody who I could imagine could do, say something like help. You know, I changed my diet. I tried formula. I tried not for, you know, I nursed him for the, or had breast milk at any rate for the first full year. But, you know, I think that it was hard. It was really hard because he was obviously very unhappy in his body, and he would try, you know, he would try to be bright and happy. You know, you could watch him, and then you just watched him just, he'd wake up and cry. He was just, it was really hard. And I think that first year, that was really hard on us all. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it was hard to be Finn. Mm-hmm. It was hard to be me with a screaming baby. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't go anywhere. You know, you can't go places because people don't want to be around crying babies. So it was very a lonely time. Things were very tense between Eric and me. And it was, you know, he didn't want to be around a screamy baby either. Mm-hmm. And it's very hard to be with a baby you can't soothe. And it was just intense. It was difficult time.
Did it change? Did you feel like the template of your marriage shifting? When I think about
that. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Huge.
Because I mean, you go from, we live at the top of a ski area and we're hiking and we're so independent. And then it's just so radically different.
It is. And you know, I look at all the things that we were doing before we had a baby and all those things that stopped. For instance, I never backcountry skied again. We never went river running again. We stopped climbing mountains. We really, like, all of those, all of that glue, all of that adventure glue went away. And that was a really difficult time for us. You know, I think we did a little bit of camping with Finn, and honestly, it just wasn't fun. It was just hard. It was a hard, I'm not lying, friend. That was a hard period of life.
How long did that last? Do you remember a time when he stopped screaming?
You know, I think things, it helped when he could. So I did sign language with him. And as soon as he could start signing, that helped a lot. Then when, you know, as soon as his speech came on, which was slow, he was actually slower to speak than a lot of his very precocious little girl baby friends. As the more he could express himself, the easier it got. He still was intense. You know, he still would throw incredible fits, and it was that when I remember the big change, Rebecca, is that he was difficult, and he had this intensity to him. And when I took him to daycare, I remember he was in this classroom, and the first time that I went to a parent-teacher conference for him, they went on and on and on about this kid who was just so smart and bright and, you know, sweet with his friends and helpful, and I said to them, you know, I'm Finn Tromer's mom. And they were like, yeah. And I couldn't fathom that this child that they were discussing was mine. I mean, I knew he was all those things. I knew he was smart. I knew he had this capacity for sweetness. I knew that I knew who he could be, but I knew that he had a whole other side that apparently he wasn't expressing in school. So it was shocking. And that went on, by the way. It was a little Jekyll and Hyde-ish. His whole life, that he had a personality outside of the home and another personality in our home, where I think he just felt very safe to fall apart. And when he was out in the world, he had a very strong impulse to put his best foot forward always, which he did, which he really did.
He really did. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's one of the reasons that so many people didn't understand his taking his own life, is it didn't match with what they saw.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The year that Finn was born, so much changed between you and Eric. Did that template then just stay? Do you remember the relationship just sort of staying in that space?
I feel like our relationship changed so many times, Rebecca, over the course of, well, of our marriage, and certainly over the course of Finn's life, it also changed many times. But I'd say we do now. We never went back to river running, but we do climb mountains again together, and we ski a lot together. So Nordic skiing.
When did that start? When did you start climbing mountains together again?
Really? I think after Finn's death.
Okay.
But we've been Nordic skiing together quite a bit all through the...
Did the kids Nordic ski?
No, neither of them liked it.
Okay. Yeah, most kids don't like to Nordic ski. It's too much work.
Why do I have to work this hard?
Yeah.
This is not fun.
Skiing is supposed to be downhill and I'm going fast. And you just have me sweating.
Yeah. Well, let's see. So where do you want to go? I mean, I think we could talk about, I don't mind actually talking about right after Finn died, because there was, I have a very strong memory of that afternoon, that night, how very tender Eric and I were with each other. How very generous we were with each other to treat each other with as much respect and gentleness as possible. I don't think that either of us were surprised, although that's not to say we weren't enormously surprised. I mean, I think that
of course.
And I think that what I noticed right away was that we did not blame each other. We did not, you know, there was no sense of you should have, or if only, or there was none of that. And there was also no direction for, like, you should be doing this now, or that it was just an astonishing sweetness, tenderness in the way we immediately started giving each other as much space as we needed to do whatever we needed to meet this most awful thing that had ever happened to us.
How do you account for that? There is so, most people who have had to go through what you went through blame each other. And that would have been understandable, that the human reaction is to say, no, I don't want this, and it's got to be somebody's fault. And it's just so
human of us to blame.
I think that's both of our nature, not to blame. If I'm going to be really, really honest, there might have been a moment on that first day when I thought, you know, you. And it was so easy to see through it. You know, I could feel it, some impulse that rose up that wanted to blame, maybe. And I just thought it didn't hold. It couldn't hold. Right. It just became so clear that there was nothing that could be done except to love each other as much as possible right now in this moment, that was the only thing that was going to do any good. I guess I want to be honest as possible about, I think there was a moment where the blaming impulse did show up, and I was able to see through it as something that was, I suppose, not helpful and also not true. Not true. I mean, no one could have done anything. I really believe that. And it wasn't about him, Eric. You know, it was about us supporting each other at this point as much as we could in the wake of what had happened, which was, I remember both of us that whole night just lying in bed, crying, holding each other. And saying, I love you.
Yeah.
And I went and, of course, spent a lot of time that night with Vivian also.
To be able to have I love you be the words at those moments instead of I hate you, which would be the blame response. I'm thinking about the template that gets created when Finn is born and is screaming and creates this household where the template of your marriage shifted at that time. And then it feels like to me that there is a new template when he dies of I love you.
It's true. I do think that's true. I think that, and I can't tell you exactly why, Rebecca, except that I can say that in general, there was for me, and Eric too, by the way, a sense of so much love coming toward us from other people, right? I felt it almost immediately, this kind of, I called it the tsunami of love, which I felt as this energetic, enormous wave that I was terrified of as I like saw it approaching me. And then, you know, and then it crashed over me even as I was like, no, like it's too much. And it didn't care. It just crashed over and took me. I joke about it, but it's so real to me, this astonishing amount of love that I felt pouring into our family. And I don't doubt that that is in large part because we were so cradled by love, able to be loving with each other because we were so loved, taken care of energetically, but in real ways too. All the people who showed up with food and flowers and, you know, candles and cards, and it was just this kind of astonishing overflow of support. So I don't know how anyone would do would meet this kind of a tragedy without that much support. I can't even imagine. And it was just astonishing overwhelm of support, which I know that Eric has said that, and I think his initial response also was like, no, we've got this. We can take care of ourselves. I don't want a food train, meal train. And I said, no, actually, I need help. And we're getting this help because I need this help. Mm-hmm. I actually can't take care of this myself. And so he bowed to that. He had wanted to say no. And in fact, we were fed for, I think, 3 months. And it was, I think, amazing for all of us to feel that support and love. It affected all of us in the ways we treated each other, but also I think in the ways that we see other people in need now and have a sense of compassion in a new way. I think you don't know until you know, and now with our eyes wide open to just how much a heart can break, I think we're able to see other people's tragedies in a different way too, and to feel compassion in a whole new way.
You're bringing up this idea of receiving love, especially when love feels like a tsunami of love. And I want to just ask you to describe that a little bit more, just the granular, because really, you did have an enormous body of people whooshing love on you.
Oh, yeah.
And many of us, I'll speak for myself, trying to hold myself back because I knew I might overwhelm you. Because the amount I wanted to take your pain away or help you hold your pain was so overwhelming to me. Yeah. And then I imagined that multiplied by so many people who love you. And I just thought, that's going to squish her, right? I felt worried about the tsunami headed at you.
Yeah, it was quite something, Rebecca. And like I say, I actually, there was a moment, this was the day after he died, when I said no to it. I did. I was like, okay. No. And the love energy did not care and just carried, just like swoosh through me. It did feel, I had so many, it was very, very embodied, this whole experience. The pain was embodied. The feeling of being carried was embodied. The sense of being loved was embodied. I really did have this sense, I do to this day, Rebecca, that I was like physically remade, like remade by love, like as if it went into every single cell of me and remade me. It was, I can picture it. Like if I close my eyes, I can see what that remaking process looks like. There are so many ways to talk about it. Like for instance, there was this sensation that all of the love coming from different people was like this red light that came up from all the different people in it, and it went to like a one central place and caused it, and there was like this giant glowing red ball of laser red light that just then took one single laser beam from that straight to my heart, and just like and it was constant. It was a constant feeling. I had this sense of this bright red light being beamed into my heart. And I could feel it. Like I felt the energetics of it. If people could see me, they'd see that I'm shaking my hands. It was this kind of hummy, resonant, energetic, science fiction-y red pulsing. that sounds crazy, but it still to this day feels real. And I can tell you how much it did change me. It's changed. To this day, I'm discovering ways that the things that the old stories fell away, that love was possible. You know, I think about what could have happened. I think about how other families do fall apart in a tragedy. And I can't imagine that other layer of trauma added to the primary trauma of losing Finn, of losing your beloved child. And then on top of that, to be at odds with your partner, or to be fighting with your other child or children. I cannot imagine it, because the closeness then that Eric, Vivian, and I were able to achieve, the safety of us, the security of us, the certainty that we were in this together, and that is a large part of what made it possible. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm remembering that Eric and I had this really beautiful ritual of every morning after Finn died, we would sit and meditate for 10 to 15 minutes together, just sit there quietly. And I know, I don't know what he was doing in that time, I know he was sitting there quietly and meditating. But I was very actively just praying for Finn to be well, whatever that looks like. I have no idea what happens after we die, but I felt aware that something was happening. And so I just loved him as much as I could, just beamed love to him so intentionally to, you know, what does a mom want to do? You want to do everything you can for your kid. So I didn't know what there was to do. So I just loved as hard as I could, as focused as I could.
You sent the red laser beam, like bouncing off of your
skin. Right. I had this very, I wonder if I can remember it now. Gosh, I have it written down, Rebecca, but it was a dream in which I was, there was a flag, and it was a red background of a flag. And in the center of the flag was a full solar eclipse, so that it was dark shadow, all shadow, and then there was a flaming corona all around the dark shadow. Mm. And I was aware there was a little boy. And he told me what to do, that I had to pull all of this energy, this love, and pull it through into the shadow. And so I did. There was this gorgeous swirling energy, and all night long, I just pulled this beautiful, glittering essence through the shadow, and I knew that it moved through the shadow and into that brilliant, brilliant light that was flaring behind it. I did it all night long.
And that meditation that you would do each night of pulling the love through the shadow into the corona of light, how did the little boy come to you and just tell you, this is
what you do? Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. It was a dream, you know, that was a dream, but it was profound.
My hunch, Well, and my hunch is partly you were asking the question, what do I do? What do I do? And yeah. And you were open to that answer
yeah.
of it's still about love, Rosemary. It's still about receiving love and love and pouring love.
Yeah.
Receiving love, pouring love, receiving love, pouring love.
It was so obvious the whole time. It still is. But, you know, so 2.5 years later.
I've always felt like your poetry practice prepared you for this. But I'm also just wondering, do you have any different understanding of how you had prepared your heart unconsciously, unknowingly, to receive this tsunami of love? And maybe I want to just take a minute to have you describe really what that tsunami felt like as it was coming toward you, because it really was scary for you.
It really was scary. It was Rebecca, it was a wall of love. It was a huge wall of love.
Yeah.
Not love doesn't seem scary, but a wall coming toward you feels scary.
When so, you call it a tsunami and it's about to overtake you. Yeah, and that's what it did. It really
And that is what it did. It did. Yeah. It did. And it was fast, sweet friend. It was fast. It just really you know, it was almost like I looked over my shoulder and saw it coming and said, and I just felt my whole body, you know, just like contract in like just this looks dangerous. No. And I didn't have much more time than that. It wasn't then. And then it was on me. And then I was like, you know, I can hear myself say it and think that sounds so crazy, but I can promise you that that's exactly how it went.
So my question is, how did you receive it? And my hunch is there wasn't an option.
It wasn't an option to receive it, Rebecca. And, you know, I have felt this way since Finn's death so many times, you know, that truly the horror of it was so great that I couldn't anything, you know, I remember the first few weeks, like every single little thing I did, I said the word okay after it, just because I was aware of the smallest thing. You know, I got to the car door. Okay. I opened the car door. Okay. I sat down in the car. Okay. Like it was that, even the smallest thing took everything from me, it felt like. And I just felt like there was no part of me that could struggle. There was no part of me that could say mm-hmm. yes. There was no part of me that could say no. I just, this is why I needed people to take care of us. You know, I just couldn't. And what was astonishing then about that was this sense that really grew in me as you know, the weeks went on, that I didn't have to do anything, that love would do it for mm-hmm. me, that love actually would rise up and do it for me. And I was just aware of, yeah, I just kept saying it just felt like there was no agency. I had zero agency. It took zero effort from me. Things took no effort because love was doing it. And that sounds so strange, but this is how it was. And sometimes to this day, it still is this way. I learned how to trust it in a way, but life now is nothing like it was in the beginning there. Although I can say that there is a sweetness, a trust, a generosity that has sustained Eric and I, that did change our marriage and has continued to change our marriage, that there's there is a closeness now unlike anything we ever had before, that I think that we have an understanding now of what we've been through that no one else could ever understand, you know, and in such an intimate way. And also just, I think that practice over the time of allowing each other to do whatever we needed to do, right? I wrote, Eric pruned. He went out and pruned the whole, I like to say he pruned from our house to New Mexico, which is not quite true, but almost, you know, he just went out and pruned the world. You know, he pruned ski trails. He pruned our yard. He just went out and took care of the world. Both of us went on lots of walks. Just being outside helped us so much. But I just think about how we didn't try to make the other person's grief look like ours. How easy it was just to let each other meet it however we were going to meet it.
Were there ever moments that you questioned each other's grief process?
I don't think so.
Hmm.
Okay. I'm going to be really honest. He talked to our therapist once, and I was like, "When's your next talk with Annie?" And he said, "He was done." And I was like, "That was it, huh?" You think once is enough? You know what? Once was enough for him.
Mm.
Once was enough for him. You know, I needed to talk to people much more. I talked to you. Yeah, I talked to my spiritual teacher. And I had lots of friends. And it just turns out that so many of my friends are therapists. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, I feel very, very lucky to have some of the finest humans in the world that I call friends who really helped me through it. But to know then that was how I did it. And he didn't need friends to go through it. And he didn't need a spiritual teacher to go through it. And he didn't need a therapist. He needed some pruning shears and a wife and a daughter.
One of the things that I noticed, you know, just a couple of times being in your house is how slowly you spoke to each other. And there was a slow, and if you experience it differently, obviously tell me where I'm wrong. What I saw was, let me just check in with Eric before I take this walk. And there was just a slow approach and a slow looking in each other's eyes and a slow. Is my recollection your experience at all?
I like hearing that observation. I don't know that I would have known to say it, Rebecca, but when you say it, I can feel the truth of it, how life did slow down and how we cared for each other. You know, I would not have ever. It was important to check in. It was very important to know where everyone was and that they were okay. I include by everyone, I mean Vivian also. In
right.
That.
Mm-hmm. And because grief can be so heavy and slow and hard to orient in, right? Grief is so disorienting. That what I saw with your slowness with each other was at a very practical level, I'm not going to rush a single transition because I have to pause when I get to the car door and say, okay, I made it. Okay. That as you interacted with each other, you let there be those times for, okay, I'm going to leave the room now. Okay, I'm going to do this. And that okay that you would practice, I saw you bring it into moment after moment after moment of how you were interrelating.
To be able to turn toward each other and treat each other with such tenderness in those moments is, it's what's making me tear up with just the vulnerability of that patience of transitioning from moment to moment. And I think I'm now aware again that there are people listening to our conversation. And
hi, people.
And wanting the world to know about that permission that all three of you gave each other to experience this common tragedy in three unique ways. And you just kept giving each other that permission over and over.
Mm-hmm. And to this day, you know, I think it's no less sad today than it was then, Rebecca. Just this week, I went for a walk in Telluride while I was waiting for Vivian to do something at school. And I found myself in the cemetery. At this time of year, you know, that means you post hole up to your thighs just to get, just like going up home to Cold Hill, you know, and to get to his grave on the top of the hill. And I, you know, I took a picture and sent it to Eric. And there's a togetherness,
mm-hmm.
a communion in the heartache, that I think, you know, we can comfort each other very quietly. Stand beside each other when there's a little ambush of grief or a huge ambush of grief. But it's no less tender now than it was then around that loss. You know, it's interesting to me that we never did blame each other ever. Not in the first day, but never.
Yeah.
And
Rosemary, do you know what you would say to someone who, because I'm sure you can understand why someone in a similar circumstance to yours would blame? Or maybe you can't. I'm looking at your face going, no, maybe you can't imagine.
I can, of course I can imagine that. I don't think I would have, honestly, Rebecca, I don't think I have advice for anybody about any of this. I can tell you that what I know about it is that it's so different for everyone, and that that you do whatever you can to survive.
Yeah.
It feels like survival. Yeah. And I'm so grateful that for me, that included an enormous tsunami of love that allowed it to be the experience that I had. I'm very aware that's not available to everybody. I don't know why it isn't, but I know that isn't everyone's experience. And I wish it were, but I guess I feel like if you are, whatever you're doing your best. I know that. I know that anyone who's doing it is doing everything they can to do their best to meet this moment and to not. Well, you do fall apart. You do fall. You just do fall apart. You just do. Mm-hmm. And because you've fallen apart now, whatever happens is what's going to happen. I don't have any advice about it. I'm glad I know that what's possible is that you can come out of it loving someone more. And that you can have an astonishing intimacy,
mm-hmm.
and tenderness and communion that come from it. I know that's possible because that is how it is. Mm-hmm. I'm glad I know that. Mm-hmm. But I guess I really couldn't give advice to someone else about this. That's not helpful at all.
No. It is. It is helpful because actually I think that's understanding that none of us know how to do this. And even though you have gone through it, you can't give advice. The takeaway for me is just because I know that I was trying to hold myself back because I was worried. And do you remember when I said to you, I'm scared about how much is coming at you? And you said, Rebecca, I need it all. I need every ounce of it.
And it
made me have to look at myself and say, I'm trying to keep love from her in my high protection. And that was so fascinating to me because I was worried you were going to get overwhelmed by love.
It was so overwhelming. And I remember the moment when I thought to myself, this is too much. This is just too much. And then I imagined just one person stopping. And I was like, no, don't. I need it all. Yeah. So just even one person like not sending love was instantly terrifying. I realized, okay, way too much love is just enough. It is just enough. So it was quite... What a revelation that was to think of someone stopping. And I realized, no, the overwhelm is what was called for.
Being overwhelmed by love is what helped.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I think that's what happens to us who want to comfort. We go, I don't want to overwhelm her. And so we hold ourselves back. And you're saying, I'm not sure I wanted to be overwhelmed by love, but I couldn't imagine not being overwhelmed.
I also know though, Rebecca, this is so different for everyone. And I know that what love looks like is so different for everyone. And I guess what ultimately became very easy for me was to know that whatever anybody was doing or not doing was love. It became very easy just to translate everything as it. So whether people wrote a card or didn't, you know, if they called or they didn't, if they texted or they didn't, if they brought food or they didn't, whatever they did or didn't do, that was love. I was able to receive it all that way. Even like the stupid things people say sometimes in really wanting to say something helpful.
And not being helpful.
The absolutely unhelpful things that people sometimes said. I knew it was because they wanted so badly for me to not be hurting because they loved me. And I was able to just receive everything as I love you. I just rewrote it all in my mind as I love you.
You really did have like a little translator of I'm just.
I really did. I just. You said that you meant I love you. You know, because nobody was trying to hurt me. I knew that. You know, nobody was thinking ill of me. I knew that. It was so easy to trust that, which made it really simple just to put on my love translator. The truth is, we don't have a lot of language for grief, Rebecca, and people don't know what to say. And they don't know what to do. And the truth is that there is not one thing that they can say or do that will make it any better. They can't. Mm-hmm. And knowing that made it very easy to receive love. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, my dear friend.
Thank you.
I feel grateful to be so included in Rosemary's life. And the biggest takeaway for me today was how Rosemary didn't resist that tidal wave of love. There have been times in my life that love was trying to find its way into my heart, and I kept it at bay. I've heard from many of you about times in your life when you've shut the door on love or put a stranglehold on love so it couldn't get in. Because to let ourselves be so unconditionally loved can be terrifying, even as we long for that very thing. Watching Rosemary in the last 2.5 years since her son Finn died, I've noticed times when it might be tempting to blame or point fingers or use any other method possible to keep love at bay. But she didn't do it. She didn't resist love. She turned on her love translator and she received love in all its various disguises. I guess my prayer for myself and for all of us today is that we can similarly welcome love and truly receive all that love has to give each of us, each moment of each day, in the middle of each circumstance. I invite you to subscribe to Rosemary's daily poem at her website, wordwoman.com/a daily dose of poetry. I'll link to that in my show notes. Also, know that Rosemary regularly offers very affordable classes about poetry, which are really just invitations to know yourself and the world around you better. Do yourself a favor and connect with Rosemary. Your heart is sure to grow by being near her. That's it for today. I'm Rebecca Mullen, and this has been Habits for Your Happily Ever After, where we get clear about your marriage communication. Because when your relationships are strong, you're better able to concentrate at work, reduce conflict at home, and receive support for your dreams so you can have the courage to live your best life. If you enjoyed this podcast, I'd be grateful if you'd send a link to your friend. Habits for Your Happily Ever After is produced by Grace Smith. All our music and sound comes from Walk West Productions. I'm Rebecca Mullen. Thanks for including me in your relationship today.